Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we'll review the latest album from previous Sound Opinions guests, Proto Martyr. But first, some Yes. That's a little bit of the song Going for the One, the title track off Yes's 1977 album. Today, we're doing a classic album dissection of Going for the One, exploring its context, history, and its rich music. Later in the show, we're going to talk with Yes's lead singer, John Anderson, about the writing and recording process and how Going for the One impacted the band's trajectory forever. But first, for listeners who do not know why Yes was important, Yes is one of the foundational bands in the progressive rock movement that came mostly out of England just in the years after Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and the psychedelic explosion of 67. You had a slightly younger than the Beatles generation of mostly upper middle class or just plain upper class art students in England who, with Sgt. Pepper's, were given permission by none other than the Beatles to begin to think of rock as capital A, art. What's more, these are kids who had grown up with violin and piano lessons, right? And grand pianos at home, and maybe even a grandfather's or grandmother's Stradivarius, right? These were excellent musicians, steeped in classical music, who decide to take the consciousness, in every sense of that word, psychedelic consciousness, the consciousness of what could be done in multi-track recording in the studio, the virtuosity that they had mastered even as young musicians, to put it all together in this mix that right in the name of the genre says progressive. We are moving rock forward. Now, a lot of excess was committed in the name of progressive rock, but the best bands in the genre, I contend, never lost sight of the second part of that genre name, rock. They could be ambitious. They could do multi-part suites. They could do, you know, triple albums, but they continued to rock with a precision and a melodic power that the best rock and roll always had, right? And you know, top of the class was Yes.
Well, and they had the songs. Not only were they virtuosos, I mean, Chris Squire, among the greatest bass players in rock history. Steve Howe, just an incredible guitarist, seemed anything with strings on it, Steve Howe could learn it and master it and become one of the best players in the world on it. And then you had, you know, the drummer, Bill Bruford, who overlaps with the King Crimson show that we did. you know, one of the key drummers, I mean, a teenager, essentially, jazz, yeah. steeped in jazz, coming into both of these bands and really setting a template for them. You know, people used to laugh about Yes and progressive rock and make fun of it because it was pretentious, you know. Rick Wakeman wore a cape while he was playing these organs, you know, and it's, yeah. suddenly it was wizards and, you know.
He was surrounded yeah. by like 14 analog synthesizers and organs yeah. and Wurlitzer pianos, and you know they were nothing.
I mean, it was lovingly pretentious, but at the same time, you know, getting back to the point, there were songs there. You
yes.
know, one of the reasons that Wakeman at one point quit Yes is because he missed the songwriting that defined the early albums of the band, and he thought they had lost their way somewhat. After a half dozen of those records in the 70s and left the band momentarily before he returned for the one that we're going to talk about in a minute.
Well, and the name that you didn't mention yet was vocalist John Anderson.
Yes.
It was Anderson and Squire who founded the band in London in 1968. Many members have come and gone through the years. 19 is my count, and somewhere there is an obsessive Yes fan who will point out somebody who came and went within half an hour, and I forgot, yeah. okay? All right. Greg, I think even the hardest core Yes fan will agree that the first album, Yes, in 1969, and the second, Time in a Word, in 1970, the band is still struggling to find its identity. There's a world, and the world is love, and it's right for me. It's right for me, and the world is love. There are hints of what will come there, but those are not great records. They're still tethered to what's happening in the English rock scene, and they're covering songs, and they're searching for an identity. Members are coming and going. The first three classic Yes albums are the Yes album in 1971.
I've seen all good people turn their heads each day, so satisfied I'm on my way.
Fragile, later that same year.
I'll be the roundabout. The words will make you out and out. I spend the day away. Call it morning, driving through the sun and in and out the valley.
And Close to the Edge, mm-hmm. the first double album in 1972. That gives us the classic quintet lineup of John Anderson on vocals, Chris Squire on bass, Steve Howe on guitar, Bill Bruford on drums, and Rick Wakeman on keyboards. That gives us a lot of the hits that you hear to this day on classic rock radio, and it cements the Yes sound. Now, although I am a fan, I will say they went off the deep end after Close to the Edge. Tales from Topographic Oceans, 1973, is a triple album. Relayer, in 1974, is more pared down. Wakeman has left, and Patrick Moraz comes in on keyboards. Bill Bruford has left, and Alan White, who is no slouch.
No.
I mean, his last gig had been with John Lennon's Plastic mm-hmm. Ono Band, and he was a great session musician. He's a great drummer. He steps into Yes and eventually grows into the role. But I can't listen to Tales from Topographic. I don't know about you.
No.
My life is too short yeah. to listen to Tales from Topographic no. Oceans.
I think I listened to it when it came out at some point, and I don't think I've ever returned to it. Maybe it's great, but I, you know, I just haven't given it the time.
It's painful, yeah. and Relayer is slight. So Yes goes on hiatus for a while, partly for that great
mid-70s British rock royalty tradition of the tax rate was so onerous in the UK, they had to go live in another country for a couple of years in order to bring their taxes more into line. You saw the Rolling Stones do that. You saw Pink Floyd do that. But what happens in 76, 77? Yes is starting to think about coming together again and making another album. This thing called punk blows up in England. We see Johnny Rotten on stage with a I Hate Pink Floyd t-shirt. We see a return to primitive, emotional, straight from the gut rock and roll. You only know three chords? That's probably one more than you need, buddy.
Plenty. That's plenty.
You know, just tell us something new
and
do it short and do it sharp and do it loud. I'm fascinated by what became of some of the progressive rock bands in that era. You have Genesis pare down to a trio and make, and then there were three in 1978. You have Jethro Tull make essentially its poppiest album, Heavy Horses, in 78. Pink Floyd always remains Pink Floyd, but they get pure, downright Orwellian with the allegories on animals in 77. But I think the band that rose to the punk rock challenge, best of all, was Yes, with Going for the One, and they got there first in 1977. They're still in tax exile. They're living, but you know, they're not living like in the country. They're living in Montreux, which is best known on the banks of Lake Geneva in Switzerland for its casinos, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're rubbing elbows in tuxedos with James Bond. Think of it that way. Famous recording studio there, site of the Montreux Jazz Festival. Queen would record many albums there for the same reasons, tax exile. Yes comes back together, and Rick Wakeman is ready to rejoin, and they kick Patrick Moraz out of the keyboardist role rather unceremoniously in order to make way for Rick Wakeman, his 43 keyboards, and his cape. He comes back, right? Alan White finally rises to the occasion as drummer, and Yes puts out what is, by Yes standards, especially in the wake of the double album Close to the Edge or the triple album Tales from Topographic Ocean, this is a focused rock record, all of five songs long.
When we return, we talk with the lead singer of Yes, John Anderson, about the making of Going for the One. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from Chicago and distributed nationally by PRX. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, lemonade, shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know when you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island, so we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot, and this week we are doing a classic album dissection of the great Yes record, Going for the One. Earlier in the show, we talked about the background of the band, including the personnel changes and creative evolution up to that point. Now, we're going to dive into what the writing and recording process was like in Montreux, Switzerland. We're really excited to welcome the one and only lead singer of Yes, John Anderson. John, thanks so much for being on Sound Opinions.
Excellent. Thanks. It's great to be with you guys.
So set the scene for us. How did you guys start making Going for the One?
Well, the first thing was it was a tax year, we were told. So we had to do something outside of England. And we said, okay. And a friend of mine said he'd been to Montreux. There was a great studio there. So we went, and it is a remarkable part of the world. Montreux is on Lake Geneva, and it's surrounded by these incredible mountains with snow on the top and all that kind of thing. It's very magical. And the studio was perfect and beautiful. We set up, we started rehearsing. I'd already started an idea with Steve, which actually became Awaken, because we've been on tour. That was the thing about Yes, it was either you're on tour or in the studio, on tour in the studio for 7 years. It was like, after a while, yeah, your brain is mush. But I remember this morning in a Hilton hotel, and I was heading to the breakfast table in the morning about 8:30, and I was walking past Steve Howe's his room, and there was smoke coming from underneath the door, so I knew he was stoking up on a joint. So I thought I'd have a quick joint with him. And he was playing this riff. Dun, 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 dun. And I said, I'll see you later, Steve. I'm just going to have breakfast. He said, okay. And he carried on playing it. And I came back half an hour later, still playing it. I said, Steve, can you change key? And he went, dun, 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 dun. And I said, put on your tape recorder. And he started playing it, and I started singing this sort of a line against the rhythm he was playing. And so on. And then I said to him, okay, we've got that. That's the beginning of the verse. Now, how many chords can you play at the same time without repeating? So he started playing them, and he's recording. Probably about 8 chords, 9 chords. And I started singing, work is a man's at the ply on historical life, re-regaining the flower of the fruit of his trees. Okay, that's part two. And I remember that tape when we got to Montreux, and we listened to it and started rehearsing that. And basically the way I worked with the band was I'd set it all up that what we're going to do is like the two verses like that. And then what we need is a middle section. And I had my harp with me. So I kept playing this down, 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 down. Very simple middle, because there was so much music before that, it just needed something light and serene, if you like. And Steve did some beautiful slide steel guitar, and there's a kind of wash of sound. And Chris came in with a beautiful bass line. And Rick had joined the band, which really kind of freaked us all out, because up until probably 2 weeks earlier, we were still waiting for Patrick Moraz to turn up. He was in Brazil, as far as we knew. And we'd been rehearsing for 3 weeks by then, and it looked like Patrick wasn't going to turn up. So we thought, okay, let's find out if Rick's available. And we found out he was, and he wanted to rejoin the band. So we let Patrick go and explained the situation. So there was Rick getting ready to do a solo in the middle of Awaken, and he would play it on his keyboard, and I just kind of felt that it wasn't the right thing. And I just turned around out of the blue and said, Rick, would you like to record in a church, like a church organ, a real one? And he said, oh yeah, that'd be so cool. So we found out from the engineer at the studio that there was a town called Vevey, about 10 miles away, and they had a most beautiful church and a great church organ. And that's where we recorded the organ for the middle of the best part, I think, the most wonderful part of Awaken, where it lifted the whole piece up.
And you did it via a phone line, right?
Well, that was the great thing. We set up, me and Rick, I was in the pews with my harp, and he was up in the church organ area, and we microphoned up the church organ and the harp. So we'd recorded at the same time, and he had headphones, I had headphones. And then we found out that actually we had a mixer, and if you plug the mixer into the telephone lines, it is so clean in Switzerland that they could plug in the headphones or a lead into the phone jack in this studio and get a clear recording. So when we did that middle section, Chris and Alan and Steve had headphones on, and they were listening as we were listening to what we were doing, and we could hear them playing. So
wow.
It was like remote recording, which is what we do a lot now.
I've read a quote where you said you always loved listening to Awaken, and you felt that first when you recorded it, at last we'd created a masterwork. Now, going for the ones, your eighth album, and there are plenty of people, yes, super fans, your two interviewers included, who would say, well, there were a lot of masterpieces, you know, not to denigrate Awaken, but wow, you know, what was it that grabbed you so much?
Do you know, I think it was... It had been such a big stepping stone to do Fragile, and there were four large music pieces on that album, and then we moved into Close to the Edge, and that was a breakthrough on every level. And in some ways, we went into another situation, which was Topographic Oceans, which was not the easiest experience for everybody concerned, especially Rick. He just didn't like what happened, and the tour was a disaster for him, and it really unbalanced the band on many levels. Then we did Gates of Delirium, and when we got to Awaken, I thought, oh boy, if we hadn't have done all this music, we would have never have done Awaken. So mm-hmm. You know, you think about it and you realize that we actually got to the top of the mountain with Awaken, but it was a slow climb doing all these other works of music. So in some ways, yes, music is not hard to explain. It's not commercial in a sense. It's not radio music, most of all. So of course, we've had our hit records. I think we've only had three, which is amazing that we survived 50 years or whatever, musically speaking.
Yeah, and that song too, Awaken, seems to be very much, I mean, people have heard it as a hymn. There's a very spiritual quality to it. Those lyrics, you made it sound like the lyrics were very spontaneous when you were in that room with Steve Howe recording it initially. I mean, what were you drawing inspiration from a lyrical standpoint?
A feeling of contentment that we were working on music that I believe was probably the best music we had tried to do over that 10-year period. When I look back at the songs, I wrote a song with Alan White, but it was all about a sculptor sculpturing his lady of his life who eventually passes away within the song.
Yeah, turn of the century, right? Because it's the story of Rowan the sculptor, right?
Yeah.
realizing the form of the stone, Satan's moving. Roanne, she kissed heart through his working hands, put to mold his passion into play, like the sun.
And again, I walked in the studio early at 10 or 9:30, and there was Alan playing these chords, and I automatically started singing and sketching down some lyrics. And then Steve arrived, and he started playing the chords, and I suggested to him, listen, Steve, why don't you just play solo guitar all around what I'm doing? Chords are here, you know, on the piano. So he got the idea right away. And to write something that had a storyline and it built, and there was something very magical about writing that song. Wonder Stories and Awaken, of course. And my main thrust in terms of lyric was always to try and figure out what I'm thinking about the diversity of spirituality in the world. And I've been reading so much about it over the years, and I'd sort of found that there are certain levels of lyric that you can actually sing without getting into being a bit sort of churchy or preachy sort of thing. It's a delicate balance where you're trying to explain to myself what I'm thinking about.
The other thing I remember as a Yes fan, this record coming out, you know, during the height of punk in the UK, and that was in the air, and you know, progressive rock was being sneered at by some of these new upstarts, and you kind of, I thought you were almost poking fun. There was an element of humor in this record. It's kind of sly, but I on Going for the One, where you talk about your cosmic mind, I almost felt like that was kind of like a little joke, a little in-joke about, oh, yeah, that John Anderson, he's the cosmic mind guy, you know? It's like,
well, and then it comes around to that line, which kills me every time, John, where you're like, you're rocking, rolling, you know what I mean? It's like there's not a difference between you and The Clash. It's all about the emotion in the music, you know?
Very true. You know, we were surviving punk and then disco. It's kind of... I agree. It was, I was making light of myself, making light of the idea that I might be a bit too cosmic man.
and that song rocks like crazy, Going for the One with...
We used to open up the tour with that song.
And, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
What a great song. How on Pedal Steel, and, you know, he gets sort of an... It's almost like a slide guitar. It's a bluesy, really... You know, just a intense blues feel, and I don't think you know, people talked about Yes. Oh, they know they're blues. You know, and here was just like a proto blues type of feel. How did that emerge, that Howe was playing pedal steel on that song, and that feel, that sort of bluesy country feel came across?
It just, out of left field, I was singing the song, which is me on guitar thrashing away on my acoustic guitar, and he's setting up a steel guitar, and I'm thinking, are you sure? You're going to play it on that sort of thing? But I didn't say anything until we, you know, Alan counted it, and then... It's like, oh my God. We're rocking and rolling here. And it was very exciting day when we recorded that song.
Well, there's an element of uplift. It's anthemic. It's inspiring. And you've said it was... Now, because you had written the song, and the story goes, and you know, some of these stories, John, are apocryphal perhaps, right? But the story goes that, that hearing a demo of that was one of the things that convinced Rick Wakeman to return to the band. And, you know, of course, it's the title track. And, you know, but there's something about it. Something like, we're still here. We're embracing life. We're alive. There's this element of sport, right? Of like grabbing the brass ring, of being the gold standard. It's unusual in the Yes canon for being so just like, you know, you can do it. Come on.
Yeah. Let's do it. You know.
Yeah.
It happened. I think it happened on every album. There was a certain point in each album where we were trying to figure out, are we doing the right thing here? And then all of a sudden, we get into something and we realize, it's okay, don't worry, we're on the right track.
What was that turning point for this record?
Awaken, when we were driving back, me and Rick, from the church in Vevey, and he said, I'm going to write out a choir part for this song. And I took a deep breath and said, oh, that would be so good. And when he did that, and then the choir came in and sang, and I didn't go to the actual recording because I just wanted to let Rick get on with it. And I came in as the engineer was mixing it, and I'm sure I was floating about a foot off the ground. I was so exhilarating that people were going to be able to hear this music and this choir coming in at the right time. And oh my God.
Into the theories that people have of this as kind of being a, if not a reinvention of the band, you guys rethinking it a little bit in terms of how you wanted to approach things, or do you feel like that's been overblown? Like, oh, this is Yes's response to all this new music coming out at that time?
No. I was thinking that we were still on the same path, and we got to the top of the mountain of musical ideas that we'd done over the years, and we'd actually finished up with that wonderful work, and it was done in with love and hope and belief system that we had at that time. And you know, being in a band is like a, it's like Jell-O sometimes. You're never quite sure if it's gonna form correctly or come together correctly. It's like some tours, not everybody's happy, you know, and you get overworked by management. We actually did a tour just to pay our tax bill. It's like in the 70s, we just had to keep going. And then towards the end of the 70s, to finish up with an album like Going for the One, was such a relief on many levels for everybody, I think.
We have been talking to John Anderson, the lead singer of Yes, for many, many years, many masterpiece albums and 15 studio albums. John, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, you guys. I appreciate it very much.
I don't know about you, Mr. Cott, but the 14-year-old Jim DeRogatis was really excited to talk to John Anderson again.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and it sounds like you hoped John Anderson would.
Yeah,
here's
he hasn't
this man
changed.
In his 70s with the same sounding voice as he did when he was being interviewed in the 70s.
Man, I was high for a week. If you're a member of our Patreon community, you can hear more of our interview with John Anderson, including a conversation about his latest solo album and the story of the last time he saw his close friend, Yes bassist Chris Squire, before Chris's death in 2015. When we return, Greg and I'll dissect two tracks off Going for the One in depth, and later we'll review the new record from Detroit rockers Proto Martyr. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from Chicago, distributed nationally by PRX.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot, he's Jim DeRogatis, and this week we're doing a deep dive on the progressive rock band Yes.
We want to wrap up our classic album dissection of Going for the One, this masterpiece by Yes from 1977, by talking about two songs we didn't discuss as much with John, one for each of us that we truly love, and you are going to go first.
Yeah, Jim, I wanted to shed some light and some love on Parallels, which is the third of three songs on side one of the record. I just thought it was a masterful example of what they were going for on this particular album, that more rocking approach that you were talking about. Here was a band clearly, excited about being back in the studio, creating music, and creating music that really moved, that had sort of a pulse to it, and a sort of a dynamic that had been missing on at least the two previous records. Parallels was sort of a leftover in some ways. Squire had written the song originally intended for a solo album called Fish Out of Water that he put out in 1975, but he really, at the end of the day, he decided it didn't really fit in with the theme of that record. So it was resurrected for these particular recording sessions. And when he pulled it out, the band was pretty excited about it. They thought it had a lot of potential. It did not have any central guitar riff. Enter Steve Howe.
Yeah.
I know how to do those.
Yeah.
Howe was, I think, just a key part of this record, Jim. I think his role in this record was crucial in the way it sounded and the more rocking approach. So you get a very rock song with a very rock Steve Howe guitar solo in it. And then it's backed up by that roaring pipe organ by Rick Wakeman.
Recorded at the church that John Anderson was telling us about.
Exactly. I mean, and they were wiring this up by a phone call. You know, it was just like incredible. Hey, here's this band. You think, oh, they're all high tech and they're artsy guys. But, you know, here they were. And John Anderson just marveling, you know, the phone service in Switzerland is just incredible.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like you're in the room with that person. Well, that's exactly what this Rick Wakeman pipe organ sounded like. And this song just rocks. You know, it is one of those Yes songs that, is within the progressive rock realm. It's not a short 2-3 minute, pop single ditty. It is definitely progressive rock, but emphasis, as you said, on the rock. Those four letters, to me, were the template for this record. And this, to me, is the sterling example on the record of that approach. It's not the best-known song on the record. It's not the most revered song on the record, but I think it is emblematic of where they were at this time.
You've been playing with fire. Hear me when I say to you.
Parallels is a great song, Greg. So I want to talk about Wondrous Stories, one of two songs on the album that are written by John Anderson alone. He was a key player on this record. He said that it was a beautiful day when he was living in Switzerland, one of those days you want to remember for years afterwards. And the lyrics kind of spilled out all at once, came into his head, he went home, he wrote them down. This is a song, he says, about the joys of life, as opposed to the uptightedness of some aspects of life. You know, bless John Anderson. He's a hippie, man. He's in his eighth decade, you know, seventh decade. He's still a hippie. I love that. You know, I think that the knock on progressive rock, and the knock I've gotten as a critic my whole professional career, is that there's a weird split, Jim, between your love for progressive rock and psychedelic rock and punk rock. I don't know. You know, as a kid growing up in Jersey City, it was an awful place to grow up. It was a tough upbringing. I was happy for any way to escape Jersey City, whether it was rolling around in the dirt with the punks or soaring toward the light angelic with the progressive rockers. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to go somewhere else. And, you know, Wondrous Stories is a song about that, is a song about imagining yourself in an idealistic utopian environment. You know, I loved Lord of the Rings. I played me some Dungeons and Dragons. I was a fan of fantasy. You know, and I wanted to return to hear your wondrous stories. Hearing, as John Anderson sings. I would encourage anybody to look this up on YouTube. It's a really short pop song by Yes standards, 3.5 minutes. But in those 3.5 minutes, Steve Howe plays, it switches back and forth between three different instruments like nonstop. He's playing acoustic guitar, he's playing mandolin, he's playing electric guitar. Wakeman's doing, you know, this great, I think it's a Polymoog, but that might just be the Hammond, or it's probably both. There's a really neat, very subtle, which is not something progressive rock gets credit for, very subtle rhythmic shift in an unexpected way that Squire and White lock into. But it's John Anderson's song, and he really steals the show with a vision of a better place where we can marvel in wonder. Sounded silence, me leaving no trace. I begged
That wraps up our discussion on Yes is Going for the One, and now we want to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any memories of listening to this album or any thoughts about what it sounds like today? Comment on Facebook or Twitter with your opinions and stories.
That is a little bit of the song Tranquilizer from the new album by Proto Martyr, Ultimate Success Today. Some irony in that title, Greg.
Mm-hmm.
We have been big fans of Proto Martyr for some time. I have to credit you with turning me on to them. They were guests performing live and talking about their work on the show in 2014, episode number 479. This is a post-punk quartet that formed in Detroit in 2010. They have now hit what they are calling a mile marker, a decade as a band. Looking back, they have reissued their first album, No Passion, All Technique. Joe Casey, the very literary singer who fronts the band, has called this a possible valediction of some confusingly loud five-act play. The new album has a number of interesting guests from the avant classical underground, including the cellist from Chicago, Fred Lonberg Holm, and there's saxophone and there's clarinet, a vocalist Nandi Rose Plunkett. This is a band that is always evolving, always moving forward. But Casey, who has always been very frank in talking about dark, often, issues in his own life, is looking back at this point in time. We'll get into more of what that means on Ultimate Success Today. The title, by the way, Casey has said, comes from those late-night infomercials that dominate on TV. Let's play a song first, though. This is Processed by the Boys from Proto Martyr on Sound Opinions.
When the ending comes, is it gonna run? Just like a wild-eyed animal, a foreign disease washed upon the beach, a dagger punch from out of the shadows.
Processed by the Boys from Proto Martyr's new album, Ultimate Success Today. We talk a lot about Joe Casey as being sort of an everyman sort of figure. You know, he is all of us in some ways, you know. Unassuming, very thoughtful, sharp sense of humor, student of the human condition. The human condition, which, by the way, is on life support, if you listen to this record. Casey is, painting some pretty bleak pictures. That track we just played, Processed by the Boys. When the ending comes, is it going to run at us like a wild-eyed animal? I mean, you know, basically, you know, when the apocalypse is kind of one of your big themes, you know, it's not going to be a cheery show, and why should it be? The protagonist in these songs, it sounds like he's an insomniac going through an anxious, another sleepless night, dread mixed with rage. You know, the whole notion of where's the world going? Why am I here? And, you know, he's processing this in different ways, you know. Various forms of terror, from the mundane, you know, you talked about the infomercial hell of modern business hymns, to something like A Worm in Heaven, which, as far as I can gather, is about the afterlife as the lowest of the low. Even in the next world, you're still scum, you know. Yeah, it's kind of like you can't rise above under these conditions. And yet, you know, it makes it sound like it's a hopeless task. I don't think it is at all. I think he's approaching it from a standpoint of a skeptic who believes the world can be better than it is. And the band is so great at setting the mood in each of these songs. I feel like Greg Ahey, as a guitar player, is truly inventive. that guitar comes at you like it's lunging at you from the shadows. Like when you least expect it, here it comes, and it just hits you over the head, and then it recedes again, you know, hiding and lurking in the shadows again until it strikes again. Casey is unassuming, but at the same time, he's stretching that voice, that sing-speak voice. There's actually some pseudo-crooning near the end of this record, where you're actually trying to do some actual singing. Jim, I think this is one of the best bands of the last decade. I don't think they're nearly commercially accessible enough for a lot of people perhaps to share that opinion, but I just think they're doing things that few rock bands are doing in the last decade.
You know, you're absolutely right. They are. I have to give the rhythm section a shout out.
Oh, yeah.
Scott Davidson and Alex Leonard. These are guys from Detroit. In the great tradition of the MC5 or the Stooges from nearby Ann Arbor, you know, there is a consciousness of Motown and groove in everything they do. Just listen to a little bit of the groove on that song, The Aphorist. If you ever saw his boss go ahead. Meanwhile, you're right, there is almost a metal ferocity in the attack of the guitar. But, you know, Casey's vocals are so non-metal, and there is nothing metal about the arrangements, in the sense of this is minimalist rock in kind of the Chicago tradition of a band like Tar, right? It's aggressive, it's bared down to the bone, and it's just incredibly powerful. It's an extraordinary record, and I really recommend it. Around a distant star, so concrete corner, shell by proxy, stuck on her. Do you have thoughts on the new Proto Martyr record? Leave us a comment on Facebook or Twitter and let us know. We will be incorporating listener segments again in the future, Greg. But what do we have on the show next week?
Jim, next week we have another edition of Sound Opinions Reports. We're going to dig deep into how the record stores are faring during this pandemic.
You can download the Sound Opinions podcast wherever you get such things. Thanks, as always, to our supporters on Patreon. Sound Opinions was produced by Andrew Gill and Alex Claiborne. The future is a